Great to be here, Nick.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the Nick Calera Show. Our guest this week is Robin Hanson, author, educator, and kind of a polymath public intellectual. Robin, welcome to the show. Thank you. Yeah, I've really enjoyed diving into your work and super excited to have this conversation. I thought maybe to start in a different place than I normally do and get into spiritual stuff and the sacred, because I know you've done a lot of thinking on that and I've been wanting to pick your brain about one particular topic. And that is the Bhagavad Gita. It's a work that I came across maybe a decade ago, and it's after reading everything, the Christian tradition and other traditions, I always come back to this one. And in that work, they articulate three pathways to self-realization: the path of knowledge, the path of love, and the path of service. And my first question on this work is, what do you think of the idea of spiritual realization in general?
So first of all, I have not read this thing, but I'll take this as a recommendation to read it. Maybe you have a translation you could recommend.
Yeah, I'll send you one. There's a phenomenal one. Yes. Yeah.
And so you're asking about spiritual realization.
Yep.
So obviously people do have a capacity or inclination toward things they call spiritual. And as a social scientist, one of my first tasks would be to ask, what do they mean by this word spiritual? It's not obvious what that word means in the rest of our context of our world. It's intended to evoke something, I guess, especially hard to pin down. So it shouldn't be too mysterious that I can't immediately figure out what they mean by this word. So the fact that there are some words like this is what inspired me in part to study what I call the sacred. And so Emile Durkheim is a famous sociologist, helped found the field of sociology. And his stance was that the essence of religion was the sacred. And, you know, fundamentally, when there's a whole bunch of connected concepts near each other, you're going to try to ask, well, which of these is the one I should work on first, maybe to try to understand the rest of them. And so I took the sacred to be the concept to work on first, which I think is roughly right. So then I might say things are spiritual when they are sacred. That is, when you're trying to find a spiritual realization, you might be trying to realize your sense of the sacred, your connection to the sacred, your, stance toward it, your openness toward it, your experience of it. That's my first guess at what you mean by trying to find a spiritual side.
Yeah, one of the things that's been fascinating to me as I've gotten into reading this stuff is there are all of these accounts from mystical spiritual writers, from every tradition, where they have these personal subjective experiences where they are claiming to make contact with the sacred. And then they come back and they attempt to put it into words. And none of it really makes that much sense because what they're talking about, but there are some sort of unifying themes where they're talking about concepts that human beings do know, like love or the sort of unifying nature of reality, meaning like we think we're separate, but maybe we're not separate. So there are some sort of consistencies across these things, but I'm curious, have you ever looked into in your work as a social scientist, any of this stuff?
So, yeah. I mean, I'm coming at this from two different angles. First, as a tween, a person in their young tens of 8 years of age, I basically joined a Christian religious cult that was Pentecostal. And in that cult for a few years, I experienced the sort of things that people experience in a Pentecostal Christian cult as a young person. And so I have vivid memories of that still. So I can connect to the experience, what it felt like, my motivations, my attitudes, my stances toward it. And they were definitely distinctive experiences, the sort that you might give a different name to and call people's attention to, and even remember fondly. That's one basis I have is having had direct contact with that sort of experience. And the other basis I have is, as a social scientist, understanding now after many decades, roughly how the world works and the sort of sets of theories I would draw on to understand anything, coming back to this topic and trying to make sense of all these things everybody has said about the topic as a social scientist. But still, I have that anchor of personal experience that helps me see that there is a there. There is a thing people have in mind. They're not just making it up, which you wouldn't think given all the recent reports. They're not just making stuff up. But still, the challenge is to understand, well, what is that? Now, I became less religious mainly by becoming a physicist in college. And so I'm very entrenched in the physics world point of view. And I basically believe that. So that forces me to think that when you're having these unusual experiences, it's a capacity humans have for an unusual experience, and it's there for a reason. It doesn't mean you're necessarily in touch with some, you know, physics that's different from the physics we know, but it means that in your head, there's a lot of capacities and abilities and inclinations that you might not be aware of and might not usually touch on. So I would think, what is this thing in your head? What is it doing? Why is it there? And what is it reacting to or how when you have these experiences?
Interesting. And based on sort of your own experiences and the work you did later in life, like, do you think, maybe the question is, what do you think is the evolutionary purpose of the human capacity for that?
So Durkheim, the guy I mentioned before, he had a very simple theory, and this was over a century ago. His story was that the sacred, which was the key thing behind religion, was there to bind communities together by having a shared view of something. So, you know, a simple story would be, if we as a community have a sacred tree, one of the key thing that binds us together is that we have this unique view of the tree. We each get how important the tree is and how special it is. Other people don't get that. That binds us together as a group, and it can bind us even more strongly than just making a deal or having a cooperative relationship just because that's convenient. So if we're cooperating, say, and then you betray me, I might go, this is done. We're over. Bye. I never want to see your face again. Okay. But if you're one of the only other people who gets the sacred tree in the whole world, even if you betray me, I mean, I still have the strong connection to you. And it's still important to me that you stay in my world. And I have to repair this somehow if I can, because I need other people who get the sacred tree.
That's fascinating. Did he completely explain it that way? Like, did he argue that this is all it is, or did he leave room for the existence of God?
Well, he's pretty clearly explaining it this way as this. Now, yes, I mean, you don't have to accept that necessarily.
Sure.
But
yeah,
just to back up a bit, I initially turned my attention to the sacred in the last few years because there's a lot of institutional changes that I'd like people to consider, big ways we could change the world. And when I offer these changes to people, a common response is, you're messing with the sacred there. People aren't going to like that, Robin. Stop. And so I realized this is in my way, whatever this thing is. So I should figure it out, try to understand it, and better appreciate whatever this thing is that's in my way. And maybe I could move it out of my way or move around it or something, accommodate this thing that's in my way. So that's was my prominent initial purpose to dealing with this. But then what I tried to do is survey all the things I could find people saying about correlates of the sacred, what attitudes, behaviors, stances, opinions tend to go along with it, including these feelings and experiences. And then that's my data set. And the question is, can I try to explain that? You know, what theories could best explain that? And when I went reading about the sacred and then trying to talk to some people, I did some interviews with people, and I realized something that I hadn't anticipated when I was doing this analysis, which is most of the people who spend a lot of time thinking about the sacred, perhaps yourself, they are people interested in the topic because it's sacred to them. The concept of the sacred is sacred to these people, and they want there to be a special explanation for it. That is, if I come into it as a social scientist, I say, okay, different people treat different things as sacred. What explains the habit of different people to pick different things as what they treat as sacred? And the people for whom the sacred is sacred, they go, no. See, the thing is, there are really some things in the world that are sacred. And the reason that me and my friends treat those things as sacred is because they really are. And you're trying to find a capacity or tendency toward that in the human mind is missing the fact that, no, there really is the sacred stuff there. And that's why we're into the sacred. So you can see that's an obstacle right there, because there's all these groups who their favorite explanation of the sacred is that there really are sacred things that they see around them that they're relating to. And that's why they have. So basically their story is, well, the reason why we have this particular way of relating some things is that's the appropriate way to relate to this special thing, which really exists, which really is sacred.
Yes.
So you can see how right there, there's a conflict, because I'm going to be using the more usual social scientist approach of saying, okay, people obviously have this capacity and tendency. Let's collect a bunch of correlates and come up with the simplest explanation of that tendency. And my simplest explanation is not going to be to invoking the class of special things that are weird and unusual with respect to our usual way of understanding things. I mean, that's on the table. I'm not excluding it. But, you know, if there's another theory that explains this stance and relationship in terms of more ordinary stuff, I am going to favor that if it seems to work out.
That makes sense. Yeah, it's like, I forget the psychological term, but it's like the whatever makes investors look for evidence of what they've already invested in.
Confirmation bias.
Yeah, confirmation bias. There you go. Yeah, it's sort of like that, right, in a way? What the sacred, the people who like sacred.
Right. I mean, it's related to say, you know, I used to do health economics, and most health researchers are into the subject because they think medicine is really special and we invest less too little in it. And most people who study education because they think education is really great and we aren't doing enough of it. So there are often these selection effects where the people who specialize in a topic have an attitude toward that topic that's different than everybody else. And that's why they pick the topic. And the rest of us kind of have to wonder whether we can believe what they say, because they aren't neutral on this. They have a particular, you know, selection stance. They were selected for people who think this stuff is really great.
Totally. Are those the two issues where you were pushing for change, where people pushed back on you and said, hey, that's sacred? Was it health and education, or are there other ones?
I have a lot.
Okay.
we could take hours if you wanted. I'm happy to go through all my institutional changes, but yes, some of them are in medicine more. I have Buy Health, Not Healthcare, career agents for people to choose their education and career choices. Vouching for crime as a way to privatize a bunch of elements of criminal law. Futarchy and decision markets as ways to reorganize governance. So a lot of big, but many of them require substantial changes to the way we do things, and they often involve money. And one of the first things to understand is people tend to think that money is profane, and so money shouldn't be connected to sacred things. So, for example, we shouldn't be using money with respect to medicine, because medicine is sacred and money is not, and therefore whatever you do with medicine should not involve money.
One of the ideas of yours, which I think is super interesting, is this idea of sacred money, which kind of goes to this issue you just brought up around how we think about certain parts of our economy differently, like healthcare. So tell me, what's your view of what sacred money is or could be?
Okay, so I haven't explained what the sacred is or why it's there. So for this purpose, all you need to understand is we've got a thing about money and the sacred. We don't like them being mixed up. Now, we already have some kinds of sacred money in the following sense. That is, when you donate money to various causes to charity, it can get a tax deduction if it goes to certain sorts of uses. And in that sense, we've declared those uses to be more sacred. We've said, if you're using and, you know, even promoting opera or science is considered that. So it's not just, you know, helping people. It's a set of causes we decide are elevated in some sense. Similarly, when you have a will and you donate money in a will to create a foundation or something, the purposes of that foundation get more and more limited with time after you're dead. And we won't allow that foundation to be using it for non-sacred purposes after a while. And that's another way that we embody the idea of the sacred in our law about the use of money. So there's already a sense in which we have a sense of which kinds of uses of money would be seen to be acceptably sacred. And in law of charity and in wills, we already constrain some uses to be along those lines. Now, as an economist, I'd say the power of money in the larger capitalist economy is the idea that you can just have an idea of what the world might need. You have a bunch of money, you can go invest in some venture to try to achieve that need. And then if you succeed, you'll get money coming back because people like the fact you've achieved this need, and you'll get rewarded. And then you can accumulate more money, and then you can do this again. If you successfully several times find out what the world needs and are correct about it, and then you accumulate more money that you can use to make more bets about what the world needs. That's a wonderful thing about capitalism. But in the world of charity or sacred things, we tend to block that. We say, well, you can donate money to a sacred purpose and they can accept donations, but you can't be a sacred investor in these things, in the sense of betting that something will work out. And then if you win, getting more rewards to bet again. So that's the thing I'd like to be able to do with sacred money. And so the idea is just simple. There's a sacred bank or something. You take ordinary money to a sacred bank and they hand you back the same amount of sacred money. And the difference is the sacred money is limited in what you can use it for. You can only use it for sacred purposes. So, for example, you could establish a hospital, or as a customer, you could use it to buy services at a hospital. And when people come to your hospital, they hand in sacred money in order to buy services, and then you give them services. And then in order to do that, you pay a surgeon and a janitor, but you're allowed to pay them ordinary money because the sacred bank will authorize converting your sacred money into ordinary money to pay the people providing services to this sacred service that you're offering of the hospital. And so now, a sacred investor could say, there's a need for a hospital here. Nobody's doing it. I bet if we make it there, it'll be useful and many people will enjoy it. So you invest your sacred money into a sacred hospital and you get customers and it turns out to be a successful hospital. And now your hospital is accumulating sacred money there. And now you as the sacred investor can take some of that and use it for more sacred ventures. You can't use it to buy hookers. Maybe you can't use it to buy, you know, a yacht. Whatever the rules of the sacred money are, you're only going to be able to use it for sacred purposes. But still, we're going to allow the sacred capitalist to make bets about what we need. And that's the key thing I'd like to see, is this power of capitalism to direct attention and investment to promising possibilities and for, like, get people to take risks about things they aren't sure of. And that's what we're lacking in the ordinary sacred world today, of things being done just by charities. Charities, they'd have to solicit money to expand their business, to make a new hospital, and then the person who gave it wouldn't get any of it back. So they just do it as, so we don't really select for people who are good at making these guesses in the world of charity.
That's right. And it's the way things operate now, because that incentive structure doesn't really exist in the way that it does for pure capitalist enterprise. These organizations struggle to attract talent. They can't pay as much. And so they're often sort of not run with the same quality as, like, let's say a true venture backed company that's just out trying to make money. And so there is a consequence to society because of this breakdown, obviously.
Right. But I mean, we still haven't diagnosed the problem. We don't say, well, why is there this limit? Why can't you just use money for all these things? Why are people reluctant to mix up the money with sacred?
So we should do that.
Okay. So as I said, the first step is to collect correlates, to collect all the things people say tend to go along with the sacred, because that's our data. And then we're going to ask what theory can explain this data. So I have a paper on the subject which collects 68 correlates, 68 separate things that tend to go along with the sacred. So I take that as my data. And then I've clumped these 68 correlates into 7 themes. Each of the correlates under the same theme is roughly described by the same general idea of what that theme is. So here are the 7 themes of the sacred. 1, we value the sacred highly. Sacred things are highly valued or highly disvalued sometimes. 2, we tend to show that we value it highly through feelings and sacrifice. It's not enough just to value it. You show that you value it. 3, we are bound together. Groups are bound together through shared views of the sacred. They That's a common way that groups bind together. That was Durkheim's story. Fourth, we tend to idealize the sacred. Sacred things are simplified, cleaned up. There's less dirt, there's less defect, there's less complexity. We idealize and simplify the sacred, sacred things. That's a common pattern in the sacred. Sacred things last longer, have fewer, you know, defects. They might last forever. They might extend forever. You know, they just have fewer limits and defects. That's number four. Number five is that we like to set apart the sacred. We like to make a clear line of division between sacred things and non-sacred things. And that's part of the problem with the money mixing. It's on the wrong side of the line, and we like a nice clean line there. Do we not want that thing sitting in the middle? That's number five. Number six is that we have a norm about the sacred that you're supposed to feel and intuit it, not so much think and calculate it. Making choices about the sacred, reactions to the sacred. It should be more a sense of emotion, aesthetics, intuition, and less about math or, you know, calculation or following some chain of logic or something. And the last of the seven is the set of correlates around taking abstract sacred things and having them make concrete things sacred by association. So a flag becomes a sacred connection to a country, a love letter, a sacred connection to a romance. There are ways in which by a concrete thing that you could see and hold becomes associated with an abstract sacred thing. And that's one of the key correlates of the sacred. So those are my seven correlates of the sacred that I say encompass the 68 different, more particular correlates of the sacred. So those are roughly descriptions of sacred. And your discussion was more in number two. You said, you know, you have these feelings, you have these experiences. And I'd say that goes along with the feeling that it's special.
Yeah.
You know, experiencing that the value of it, not just having an abstract belief in the value, but that you feel and experience its specialness. And you are willing to sacrifice for that specialness. Okay, so now with these seven correlates of the series, we can go back to Durkheim's theory. Durkheim's story is that number three is the key, which is that we bind together by a shared view of the sacred. And you can see immediately that explains the first two. It explains why we would highly value sacred things and that we would show it. That is, we bind together by seeing that we are each having a shared view of the sacred. And showing each other that we have that shared view, and that's how we can bind. So it explains the first three nicely, but the other four, it doesn't do very well at. It's not that it contradicts them. It just doesn't give you much of a purchase. And why would you set it apart? Why would you idealize it? Why would you think that feel, etc.? So in order to explain the other four, my innovation, if there is one, is to note that a particular theory in psychology called construal level theory, if combined with Durkheim's story, does allow us to explain the other four.
Okay, and if it's possible, like, could you briefly summarize that psychological?
Of course. Yeah. So the psychological theory is called construal level theory, and it basically says that when we see or think about the world, so visually, for example, if you look at a scene, you see many little things far away and a few big things up close. And you think about those things differently is the key point. You have a different way you think about near things and far things, not just in spatial distance, but also in time, in hypotheticality, in planning abstraction, and a whole bunch of different ways. We just have different ways we think about near versus far. In particular, far away things we think abstractly. That is, they are described with very little detail, very few descriptors. And near things have a lot of detail, many descriptors. And so near things we think about concretely through the details, and far away things we think about abstractly through the few descriptors. And so that's what control level theory is. And it's robustly confirmed in many experiments on many topics of that we have this general near versus far way of treating things differently. And one key thing is anything that's far in one way, we tend to assume it's far another way. Anything that's near in one way, we tend to assume it's near in other ways. And we have different ways to react things that are near versus far. And there are near versus far colors, near versus far sounds, also, you know, near versus far textures. There's this is all integrated into all of our different styles of thinking. So this is a kind of fact about how we think. It doesn't seem on the surface to be saying anything about sacredness. But let's pause and notice that the fundamental claim is you think about things differently when you're up close to them versus far away. And that's an obstacle for a group of people to see something the same. Remember, the idea of Durkheim's is by seeing the sacred tree the same, having the same view of its value and its advantages and disadvantages, we bind together through the shared view of the sacred. If we see it differently near versus far, that'll be a problem. If you're next to the tree and I'm far away from the tree, we might no longer see the tree the same. We would then treat it differently. And this is more of a problem, say, for something like medicine. In our society, medicine is one of the things we treat as sacred. And if you're sick, perhaps dying, and I have just barely heard about you, you may just have a very different reaction to your medical situation than I do. And that will be an obstacle to us agreeing together about what should be done in your case, i.e. agreeing together that medicine is sacred and that we're going to have a shared stance toward it. So my proposal is the following, that with respect to things we've decided to treat as sacred, that are seen as sacred, we take a different mental strategy. Usually we see near things in near mode and far things in far mode. But if they are sacred, we instead see them in far mode, as if they were far away, no matter how close they are. Then we'll all see it the same, and then we will be able to have a shared view of it. We will be giving up the details that might help us make detailed reasoning about it. By seeing it as if from far away, we can't reason as carefully about its details, but the gain is we see it the same and agree the same. So for example, in medicine, most people are actually really bad at reasoning about the details of their medical condition. They don't want to look up studies and look at trade-offs. They just want to trust some doctor to tell them what to do. And when they do that, and the rest of us trust the same doctor, then we all agree together about what they should do because we all see it from afar. Another example I'd say is that in our society, we treat love as more sacred than sex. So that means with sex, when we're close to it, we see it different. Most of you may have this experience. When you are close to sex, it definitely changes your orientation, your perceptions. You see it different. It's got your attention. And you are very much focused on key details in that situation that change how you think about it. Other people who hear the story of it later may not agree with what you did in that situation because they weren't feeling those details. They were hearing it from afar and hearing a distant description of it. And they would apply a different set of standards to it than you would in the moment seeing the details. So with sex, we allow ourselves to react to the details, to be engaged by the details and therefore have a different reaction because of the details. So we are not seeing it from afar when we're near. We're seeing it near when we're near. Love, however, we treat as more sacred. So that means people who have been in love for decades often aren't sure they're in love. And if you ask them, well, what is love exactly? They're still not sure about it, even though they've been in love for decades. It's pretty strange. If you said if you ever had sex before, people know the answer to that. Not that confused about it. But if are you in love is something people are confused about. And but because we have this viewing love from afar, we share the value of love. That is, we agree a lot more. Love is a great thing. Our society is very much approving of love. Love is a great thing. We're not sure what it is exactly, but whatever it is, it's good. Yeah. That's the practice of seeing something as if from afar. And that's also, if you notice, we have this special feeling toward love. If you ask, if I say love is great and you notice that feeling in you, that feeling of agreeing, that's also the feeling of the sacred, of feeling the fact you're in a community that agrees with you about this, the comfort of knowing that we all see it the same, at least in your culture. And that makes you bound to the rest of us, part of us, and feels safe and comfortable being with us, knowing that we all agree that love is great, whatever it is.
Yep. Okay. And so your idea around sacred money is that given this sort of problem of the sacred. It's not really a problem, but it's a sort of a psychological problem in the sense that, yeah, you see things or you choose, you may choose to not see things. The problem with what we're doing economically is that we're ignoring a lot of the details, and the details, because we've treated certain things as sacred, and these details could actually be really valuable to improve the sacred item, whether it's, let's say, healthcare.
Right. Well, I mean, for the issue of sacred money, the problem is just more this division of things that should not touch. It's like the peas and carrots on your plate, you know, they're not allowed to touch each other. You wouldn't want to eat a pea that had touched a carrot, or vice versa or something, right? That's the kind of attitude we often have. Sacred things, we just, they can't touch other things. And so here I'm trying to put capitalists on the other side of the line. You might think, well, capitalists, they're profane. Why? Because they could use their money to buy yachts or hookers or all sorts of, they're the wrong political candidate. So you distrust rich people and all their capital. And I'm saying, well, there's a kind of capitalist that's like that. And yeah, you could say those are profane, but let's make another kind of capitalist and sharply distinguish them. And we'll leave the sharp lines, but I'm going to move something over the line. I'm going to say, look, capitalists can be sacred. Why? Because they are the things that make sacred ventures happen. Without capitalists investing in sacred ventures, there won't be as many of them. They won't be as good. If you want good hospitals, good schools, whatever, you want capitalists and you want those to be sacred, then you want a sacred capitalist. And let's put them on the other side of the line.
What's fascinating about this is that we live in an era where there's a movement towards bringing sacred principles inside the capitalist world. So we have this ESG movement, we have these impact investors, we have this whole phenomenon in recent years. Like it's a relatively new thing,
right?
A couple of decades. And so it's like, I guess maybe it's a function of the, there's been this big decline in organized religion, but people still have this sacred desire, and now it's making its way into capitalism. What do you think of that?
Well, I think people have always wanted to impose sacred constraints on capitalism. And the question is, how many and of what sort should there be? And economists have always been warning, look, you guys often go way too far and mess everything up.
Yep.
But that's part of the urge here. We have a sacred desire to say, have equity and inclusion. And we ask, how could we make the sacred desire be realized? We think, oh, let's get some sacred devoted people in these organizations whose loyalty is more to the sacred thing than it is to the capitalist organization, and shame organizations if they don't allow these people to have some control. And then they will achieve sacred ends through this devotion to the sacred in this position of control. But of course, for-profit firms are trying to sort of minimize that influence. That is to allow this thing to exist so that they don't get shamed in public, but not really let it mess with too many of their other ways to make money. And then people are going, oh, that's bad. We need to have more control. And so then the question is, how far do you go to let these priests of this sacred thing can run things? And of course, many societies in the past have had priests limiting things and controlling some things, but most societies have limited really what priests can control. Because if you let the priest take over the military or take over commerce, that could, you know, your civilization might not last much longer because that can often go badly. So that's a problem with just putting priests of some sort in charge of things without some sort of accountability or incentives. So the idea of sacred money would be, well, let's make the sacred capitalists, and they have a stake and they're trying to win, and they have, that's better than just a simple sacred priest, I would say, or you could call them priests, but they're priests with a different, you know, incentive structure.
For sure. It strikes me now just in this conversation that there's another area of research that you've spent a lot of time on, which is kind of getting at the same problem. And it's your ideas around, you know, rethinking democracy, right? Like, cause that's an area where we do treat it as sacred, right? If someone wins an election,
we definitely consider democracy as sacred in our society.
Yeah.
Especially we see it from afar. So we're not that sure what exactly is democracy, if you'll notice. Like there are these people who try to code different countries in the world as more or less democratic, and they have a lot of trouble because we don't actually have a clear rule about what is a democracy. Is it just people getting to vote? Is it enough competition among the candidates? You know, is it voting more often? What percentage of the people should be eligible to vote? We don't have a clear definitions here, but we don't need it because we all feel that we share the view of the sacred as democracy. As long as we all say democracy is sacred, then, and of course, even in the, like this current presidential cycle, one of the parties is saying their party is the pro-democracy party and the other party is anti-democracy. You shouldn't vote for the anti-democracy party because that would be against democracy. You should only vote for the pro-democracy party, you know, which is kind of a strange way to think about what democracy is. But the point is that we have it as this abstract sacred thing and we're less clear about the details.
Yeah, and we make really strong assumptions about the people who win because of this sacred belief. Basically, like we assume that the people who win are qualified to govern. And that's a line of thinking that you've sort of challenged. Why don't you talk about that for a second? I think your idea was that, what is it, futarchy?
Well, I might say there's two fundamental tasks of governance, and I might want to separate them and do them in different ways. So one task of governance is to take the preferences and desires and values of all the different people in the society and aggregate them together in a form that can then make trade-offs, can choose between things, because we know roughly what we value, how much. That's one function of democracy. That is, if we have to make collective choices, we have to trade off various values that might conflict. So we'll have to have some way to make those trade-offs. That's one function of democracy. And then another function of democracy is to aggregate not values, but information and beliefs, because we have to make guesses about what will have what effect on achieving these values. For example, we have to, if we're going to invade some foreign country, we not only have to decide how much we dislike the fact that they disrespected us or how much we want their oil or whatever it is we're doing for the invasion, we also have to make an estimate of whether it'll work. Will we succeed by invading, and will they kill lots of our troops, and will we get to hold it, or will we get pushed back, right? Those are facts and information that we need to have. And so in order to choose our policies, we need both to know roughly what we're trying to do, and we also need to guess which things work. And that's another process we need to make in aggregating things together. Now, commonly in our form of government, we have much more equality in the value part than we do in the facts part, because we assign lots of big government agencies the task of working out some of the facts. The FDA is supposed to figure out which drugs are safe. The military may be supposed to figure out where we could invade. So we aggregate beliefs in very unequal ways through specialized government agencies. And then also in elections, we have interest groups who lobby for claiming about various facts. And then we each decide which of these interest groups we trust and which authorities we trust. And anyway, there's an enormous amount of inequality in the process by which we aggregate information and beliefs to estimate what roughly works. Now, I got a PhD in formal political theory, so I spend enough time studying our usual data about politics and how it works in history and around the world. And I say, it's kind of obvious that the bigger thing that goes wrong in democracy is estimating the consequences of our actions. I mean, we do have problems sometimes in aggregating preferences in the same. Maybe you might think some people have too much influence and their preferences count for too much. And that's too bad, because maybe somebody else's preferences should have mattered more. That can be a problem, certainly. But I'd say the bigger problem in general is that we just misjudge the consequences of our actions. We go invading places where it wasn't going to work. And there were people who knew it wasn't going to work. But as voters, we believe these candidates when they tell us stories, not only about the values they will pursue, but about the policies they will pursue and their estimates about which ones will work. And then when they get elected on the basis of these estimates about the consequences of policies, they then authorize government agencies to act on the basis of those guesses and go out and do things to our harm. So again, there are two main things government must do. One is to aggregate our values, and the other is to aggregate our information, and then combine those together in making choices. So democracy is one way to do both. But when people talk about why they like democracy over alternatives, they usually are focused on the value part. The idea that a king could do whatever the king wants and the rest of us might not like what the king does, or a small elite community might have differing values from the rest of us. And that's why, as we need to have democracy so that we, the voters, can say what we want and make sure the government reflects our priorities. Okay. But we, the voters, are just really badly informed about the consequences of our actions. And so it doesn't go so well when we elect people on the basis of our beliefs about what works, and government acts on that. So I therefore would there like more of a separation between a process by which we aggregate values and a process by which we aggregate information. Remember, the way we aggregate information even now is pretty unequal. We have these government agencies, and most of us have very little influence over how they decide things and how they think about things. So I want to replace that with a still unequal but less unequal process of speculative markets, betting markets. I'm going to have, for each important question of fact, I'm going to have betting markets handle that. And now each one of you would be allowed to go participate in those betting markets. They're open to everybody, but most of you probably won't be participating that much because you will correctly believe somebody knows more than you, and you're probably right. But the betting markets will work very well to aggregate information. And anybody who is trying to lie to the betting markets, basically trying to deceive them in order to get some policy they want by, you know, messing with our beliefs, they will get crushed by other people who take advantage of them and bet against them. And so now, this is an abstract vision. Now, in order to, you know, fulfill this promise, I need to show you how mechanically we could do this. How could mechanically we put betting markets in charge of the information or fact side of government? But first I'll pause and ask what questions you might have up to this point.
Yeah, it's another fascinating idea. And as when I first heard it from you on another podcast, I was thinking about, you know, some pretty obvious things like the decision to invade Iraq, for example. I totally agree that a betting market would have figured out easily that that would, one, be a huge mistake, and two, be very costly. Because there were people in the military, out of the military, former military, everyone, there was enough people basically who would have had intelligent information that would have really re-informed the American public about the invasion of Iraq. So I really agree with the premise. I think it's a fascinating idea. And we're seeing that betting markets are still sort of nascent, but they are sort of working in the sense that they're helping to people understand what may happen in the world, what may happen in elections and stuff. So we have some good data on it, right? Like this stuff can work.
Well, when betting markets exist, then their estimates we can show are better than the other estimates you'll get elsewhere, or at least as good.
Yeah.
But most possible betting markets don't exist. That's the key high level fact. Most questions you might have about your life or your company or your city, there is no betting market on that question. So you'd have nowhere to go to get that information. So the challenge is, how could we make them exist on the important topics so that you do get that information?
Yeah. So why don't you explain your idea on that?
So I want to start with a simpler application, which is for a company and whether they should fire the CEO. So keeping or firing the CEO is one of the most, probably the most important decision most companies make. And if I can show you how to use a mechanism like this to make that choice, I think you'll see how you could use it to make many other choices regarding a company. And then we can show you how you could also use it to make choices about it, a nation or a city. So, but let's focus on the simple example. It's simpler because for for-profit firms, like where they have a stock price, we mostly agree on what we want the CEO to do. We want them to make this company worth more. So if speculators estimate a higher value of the stock times the number of stocks that are issued, then we think that was a good choice. So the question is, which choice, keeping the CEO or letting go of the CEO, would be better for increasing the stock price? So now notice we have simplified our problem because we have a clear metric by which we're going to judge, you know, outcome, which is the stock price. And we have a nice clear choice distinction. We're either going to keep them or not keep them. There's not some mixed complicated middle ground. We're going to keep them on Tuesdays, but only for marketing. That's, you know, we're going to either have them CEO or not. It's a simple claim. Okay. All right. So for this problem, I'm going to offer the solution of called off stock markets. What's that mean? An ordinary stock market, you trade cash for stock. So the price of the stock is 22. You pay $22, you get a stock. If you have a stock, you sell the stock, you get $22. When you're looking at a market like that, you're asking, should I buy or sell? And what you should do is estimate the value of the company by thinking of all the different scenarios the company could be in. And for each one, asking, well, how much will the company be worth in that scenario in terms of its long-term profits? And then weight these scenarios by their chances and come up with a weighted average of the average value of this company. And if that's higher than the price of, say, 22, you buy. If lower, you sell. That's your strategy in trading in a stock market. I'm going to introduce called off stock markets. What does that mean? Well, you're going to make a trade in the stock market, but the trade will be undone or called off if a certain condition isn't met. So for example, we could have a called off stock market where we're going to call off the trades if the CEO is not in power at the end of the following current quarter. We could have another market where the trades are called off if the CEO has left by the end of the current quarter. In these two markets, you're going to do the same weighted average over scenarios, but you're only going to limit the scenarios to be the ones consistent with this called off condition. In the one case, you're going to ask for all the scenarios I can think of where this guy is still in charge, how much is the company worth? For the other one, we're going to ask for all these scenarios where this person is not in charge, how much is the company worth? And then people could get two different prices. The price of the company if the CEO stays, the price of the company if the CEO leaves, and the difference in those two prices is exactly this market speculator advice about whether it's worth keeping the CEO. And so the recommendation is to keep the CEO if the market recommends that, and not if the market doesn't. That's how you would make the decision. And so futarchy or decision markets would be empowering the board of directors or even requiring them to just follow this market advice. Do what the market says. That would be how we would use markets to decide whether to keep or fire the CEO. Now you can see we could do the same thing for the CFO, CIO, other sorts of executives. We could, you know, keep or fire them if that was good or bad for the company. And now you could see if we had some other metric other than the stock price, we could use that instead for other organizations. Like if you were having a conference and you were trying to organize the details of the conference, we could say, well, how many people will come to this conference? And we would make decisions about the conference on the basis of, well, markets estimate that if we hold it in Cincinnati rather than we hold it in Toledo, then there'll be more people coming. So let's hold it in Cincinnati. See, you could do the same sort of thing. And we could do that for cities or national governments if we make some overall value metric of national welfare or city welfare that represents all the different things we want out of that city or nation.
It's a fascinating idea. Have you done any analysis about how much liquidity you would need? Because in public markets, I noticed this sort of when I was looking at some of the crypto things and the tokenization of real estate, like the problem with some of these nascent markets, like the real estate, is that there's no liquidity, and so you get a garbage price. So have you done some thinking on how much you'd need to have? Yeah.
Now, first of all, when you have a decision that people would like to influence, then if the markets are very thin, it would cost them very little to buy their decision. So we can see that there'll be enough liquidity right from that point of view so that we see a price difference. Like, say the price is just, there's nothing prices. And if I just come in and trade $10, ta-da, I've got the two prices I want. And it gives me the decision I want. Ta-da, I'm willing to pay those $10, right? The problem is now for me that other people go in and say, well, that's wrong. And they would be willing to bet against me. And so you can see my desire to influence or manipulate this price adds liquidity, as does other people's desire to correct my mistakes. And so a market where there's enough incentive to manipulate the price is a liquid market. basically by construction, yeah, somebody's willing to trade to manipulate it. So that's a nice feature of these markets. Now, for example, there is a DAO at the moment called the MetaDAO, a distributed autonomous organization in crypto, that's using FutarKey to make their key decisions. And they've had, you know, half dozen decisions they've made so far. And they've definitely had people try to manipulate these decisions by spending a lot of money to push for their favorite decision. And then they had a lot of people push back by trading against them. And they definitely had a lot of liquidity, a result of that dynamic. So this isn't just hypothetical. This is real. That is, if there are things that hang on a price, the price can't be really thin, because then people could buy their answer by moving the price. Like, low liquidity literally means it's easy to move the price. That's the key idea.
Yeah.
High liquidity means it's hard to move the price. So when it's easy to move the price, and you, by moving the price, you can get the decision you want, well, then it can't be easy, because somebody will say, no, I'm not going to let you make the decision that easy. I'm going to fight you. And then they do, and then it's hard to move. So then you have liquidity.
That's interesting. Okay, so let's say we zoomed out and we said we took something that sort of straddles the line, like abortion, right? Like that might be in the values category of the two functions of government that you discussed. But is there a way to use a betting market to produce an abortion answer?
Well, so in my proposal at the national level, say we would have a national welfare function. This would be like GDP, except more things are included. So we're going to hire statisticians and economists to go out and measure things in the society. And then we're going to have some way of weighted averaging these various measurements to decide basically how good things were in our country in the last year, last 5 years, whatever. That's going to be this measure of national welfare. And so now some abortion advocates may want to put their anti-abortion attitude right in the welfare function. They might want to say, look, abortion is per se bad, so we're just going to count the number of abortions as a bad thing against national welfare.
Yep.
And if you do that, unless there's some other huge advantages of abortion, they're going to win, right? Speculators are going to go, oh, well, we should ban abortion, because then this number goes up and that's our whole job. Now, there are claims, for example, plausible claims even, that say allowing higher abortion rates decrease crime rates. The sort of people who were aborted were kids who might be more likely to commit crime, and therefore abortion cut crime. Now, if we only add a modest value to abortion here in the welfare function, and speculators go, yeah, you said you don't like abortion, but you also don't like crime for these other reasons, and it turns out we think the crime effect is bigger than this, they might say, no, we're still going to be, you know, allowing abortions because of this net effect. So now you can see how multiple issues are coming together here. In this example, the national welfare function is the elected representative deciding what we care about in terms of the outcomes. And if they care about something enough, they can crank up the weight on that, and that's just going to beat everything else, and we're just going to do whatever that says. But if they don't crank it all the way up, if they say, we're kind of averse to this, we have an icky feeling about it, but it's not an infinite icky feeling, you could convince us otherwise, then it could trade off against other things that we might go. You know, for example, there might be many people who go, I want the freedom to choose an abortion. I know it's icky, but I still like to have this freedom of choice. And then that could go into the weighting. And you see different things get weighted. So the key idea is choices are a combination of what we believe about the consequences of our actions and our fundamental values, things we want to trade off. All choices are a combination of both of those things. And so both can influence a decision.
Okay, that makes sense. Super cool idea. I realize we're running short on time, but I have one more kind of big question for you. It could be quick though. Are you good? You good on time?
Yeah, we can talk. A
couple more. Okay, cool. It's kind of related to this whole discussion we've just been having about sort of alternative ways to think about democracy in our country and how to go about governance. And when I was planning out this interview, there were so many, you've written and talked about so many fascinating things. The thought that came to my mind is what would Robin do if he were put in the position of somebody like Solon, who for the audience's benefit, Solon was an Athenian who during a sort of crisis in Athens was given a brief period of dictatorial power to redesign the entire governance setup, establish new laws and rules, and then had to step down after that period. And so I thought it might be fun, just because you've got such cool ideas, is to put you in the position of an American version of that and just talk about some of the things that you would change and why.
Well, the most important issue here would be, could I delay this period? So I'd say the biggest problem we have is that we aren't doing enough small-scale experiments of interesting ideas. So what we need to do is to fund and do a bunch of small-scale experiments to find out what works. And then for the ones that seem to work on the small scale, try larger and larger scale versions of them until it works on the large scale. So I could talk to about Futarchy and its potential, but I talked about this DAO who's trying it out. The idea, we need a lot more experiments like the small DAO, and I actually know some others, at larger scales of, in other application areas in order to confirm our hope or guess that this works. And then if it works, then I might, as this dictator, impose it on this larger society. But I'm reluctant to do that given an initial level of ignorance when we could just test.
Yep.
So if you say, okay, give me 30 years and let my period of dictatorship start in 30 years, then I might, you know, knowing everybody knowing that I'm about to be dictator in 30 years, they will then maybe help me with these experiments. And then we will do a bunch of experiments and then we'll find out what seems to work. And then I could, you know, pick the most promising ones and implement, but then it wouldn't be going against lots of opinion. A lot of people would agree with me that the things I picked do seem promising because we just tried them and they work.
Yeah. That's such a good answer. Not where I thought you were going to go, but knowing your body of work, it actually makes complete sense because you could try sacred money. You could try betting markets to sort of realign capitalism and try to deal with wealth inequality and some of the issues that we have. You could try a lot of different things and they'd have low consequences at small scale.
Right.
And you could learn something. Yeah, that's a great idea.
It would be the fact that there was going to come at this point where I had a lot of power that is the thing that would get people to help me with the small scale experiments.
Yeah, totally. You just have to stay. You'd have to stay alive.
So right. Yeah. That's the problem at my current age. I might want to make it 20 years or something. You might want to pick somebody younger, but this would be the plan. Plan to do a lot of experiments.
Yeah. Okay. Love that. So I had sort of one final question to tie things all together. And it's this. So part of my motivation for starting the newsletter and actually doing this podcast was a result of all that reading I had mentioned at the beginning. I'd read all these mystics and whatnot. And I had come to this belief when I started, and I still believe it, that there's sort of a problem in our culture, in our society, where we have become incredibly self-oriented and narcissistic. And to use the lingo of this podcast, like we don't have any enough ties, you know, to that are binding us together in that sense that Durkheim was talking about. And so I believe that there's a way to rectify this, because I don't think we've gone too far down the road of narcissistic self-worship. But the fundamental premise of this podcast and my newsletter is this. We live in a world or a universe where actually we may believe that self-interested action is what we should do. But my hypothesis is that if you orient yourself in a way where you consider your work to be of benefit to your community, you end up in a better place. I'm curious to hear your just raw, unfiltered reaction to that hypothesis.
You're in a culture that I share much of. And these are exactly the sorts of things that people fight about regarding culture. This is a culture war sort of topic. When people share a culture, they quite often fight over how it should change and in which directions. And they all tend to offer reasons why their concept of how the culture should change is better, more in touch with their fundamental values, more adapted to the real world around them and changing circumstances. This is a classic culture fight. Obviously, there's been a drift in the last century toward more individualism. The world was less individualistic a century or two ago. It now is more so. It might drift back or might change back. Cultures are that are kind of hard to predict. I've been thinking a lot about this cultural dynamic processes lately and where they go. And there's two main ways to talk about culture. One is from inside, taking a side, trying to fight for one direction or another in one of these fights. The other is sort of standing outside the whole system, trying to think about how the system works and where it tends to go. So I've spent most of my time in that second mode, not deciding which way to fight my culture for going, but more asking what happens when all these people spend all this time fighting over culture. Where does that go? And what I've realized is that usually in history, it went pretty well because there were hundreds of thousands of cultures around the world. And in each one, people fought over where it would go, but there was enormous selection pressures. If your culture went off the rails, there was a famine or a pandemic or an invading army that would quickly correct your mistake. So, people in each culture would fight passionately about how their culture should change. And one side would win and the other side would lose. And then they would go off in some direction. And the net effect would be what I'd call cultural drift, in the sense that most of this change isn't directed by some, thing that has a goal and that's shooting for a goal. It's just more random fights and who wins. So that's how it used to work. In the last few centuries, though, first we crushed local cultures by creating national cultures. And we had that's much fewer cultures, a few hundred maybe national cultures rather than hundreds of thousands of local cultures. And then in the last century, we have created a global culture, especially among elites. So we have vastly less cultural variety now, which has enabled enormous within culture innovation and growth, which has made us rich and have fewer pandemics and fewer wars and weakened these selection pressures. So we have weaker selection pressures and fewer cultures. That's a recipe for drift. That's a recipe for just randomly wandering in the space of possible cultures. And it could go off to pretty dysfunctional places, but it'll take a while for you to suffer the penalty of that because you're rich. Rich and healthy and peaceful and huge cultures, just a few of them. That's what we're doing now. In the long run, that's bad. That is, we'll just drift into dysfunction and it'll take a long time to fix. I think our current low fertility is a sign of that. Our tendency drifting toward lower fertility is a sign that we are, in fact, having this dysfunctional cultural drift. And in the long run, we will eventually face, population collapse, inducing more poverty, pandemics, wars, famines, and we'll get back to having selection fix these problems. That'll be painful, really painful. I'd rather we didn't have to fix it that way, but I don't really see a solution. Honestly, my simplest forecast is groups like the Amish, who are doubling every 20 years, will just keep growing at that rate while the rest of us decline, and eventually they take over the world, and they replace our dominant cultures with theirs. So the answer in the long run to what happens about how selfish we are, where the Amish aren't very selfish, so I guess that problem gets fixed. The Haredi aren't very selfish. That problem gets fixed. Now, their concept of not selfish is a certain kind of community and devotion toward it, but it's still not selfish. Yeah. So what do you think? Are you reassured by telling you that in a few centuries, the problem will be fixed by the Amish replacing the rest of us?
Well, as expected, it was a fascinating answer. And as you were articulating, I was thinking about, we have a historical example of this that we can go to, which is like Rome.
Sure.
Rome yes. Basically built
Rome
their own.
Rome declined over three centuries, yeah. Declining fertility and population, and was replaced by the Christians who doubled every 20 years for three centuries.
Totally. And like, it took a long time. Like that was a regional.
But the universe culture. Has a long time.
Yeah. And we have now. So that was one thing. And then the other thing I was thinking about is I just happened to read Asimov's Foundation, Book 1. where have you read Foundation?
Yep, of course, long time ago.
So it brought me to this idea that it is sort of the core of the book around psych history, whatever the term is, where you could predict, knowing psychology, you could predict essentially what you just described. What do you think of that? It was Asimov onto something?
Well, and many social scientists were inspired by Asimov's book to be social scientists. The strange thing about Asimov's scenario was that he proposed that you could predict what would happen only if people didn't know about your prediction.
Right.
But we social scientists aren't trying to do that. We're happy to tell the world our predictions because the world doesn't really seem to listen that much to what we say anyway. So it's not really a problem.
Yeah. And it's like the incentive structure of
social science. But I do think we can think about what's called macro history, large scale history, large times, large space. It's possible to think about that usefully. And what I'm telling you is, I guess, an example of macro history.
Totally. Well, Robin, this was a super fun conversation. Thanks for being here and being generous with your time. I look forward to following your work and staying in touch.